Y'all hear me okay? Get it up a little higher. How's that? That's all right? Good. Well, once again, it's great to be back with the home folk. All right. Let me get set up here. I got my water. I gotta carve out a place for it under here, man. Nope, won't fit. All right. I've been known to spill it over the years here and there. All right. Y'all ready to hear the word? All right. Now, saints, come with me here as we consider the final Jeopardy category of women in science. I can just see that in Jeopardy. Women in science. Where in November of 1867, a baby girl was born in Warsaw, Poland, who would one day grace the pages of history books and encyclopedias. She was born Maria Sklodowska, and she was born poor. They were very poor. She knew what it was to miss a meal. And coming up as a young girl, she made ends meet by teaching in the local schoolhouse here and there, becoming like a governess for some of the more wealthy Warsawites, helping with their kids and all. But when she was in her early 20s, she made a decision that was going to impact the entire world. She decided that she's capable of more than just this, and she decided to apply to the Sorbonne in Paris. That's the University of Paris. It was the center of all learning in Europe at the time. And of course, she was accepted. And in about 3 or 4 years, she earned 2 degrees, one in mathematics and one in physics. And shortly thereafter, she met the love of her life, an absolutely brilliant French physicist by the name of Pierre Curie. They fell in love, married, and in 1895, Maria Sklodowska became Madame Marie Curie. And as Paul Harvey used to say, and now you know the rest of the story. Now, she was not satisfied with 2 bachelor degrees. And so she decided to go back to school and earn a PhD in physics, which she did. And in 1903, she became the first woman to receive a Nobel Peace Prize, and it was in physics. But shortly thereafter, there was tragedy. Pierre was killed suddenly in Paris by some horse-drawn carriage or something. Very tragically, he was a dyed-in-the-wool atheist, and he died suddenly. Very sorry to read about that, but that's what happened. She was heartbroken, but determined to carry on their work. They were true yoke fellows, and they were devoted to pushing the frontiers of knowledge further and further in the area of science. Eventually, she became the first woman to receive a full professorship at the Sorbonne and to have a chair and to lecture there regularly. In 1911, she got a second Nobel Peace Prize in chemistry for isolating radium. She's the one who put, you know, on your elements chart, Ra, well, it's got her name under that. She identified isolated radium and put it on the chart. And then, well, World War I came. But this was the age where science was developing faster than anybody could realize. I mean, the X-ray machine had been developed. There was more knowledge of bacteriology, serology, these kinds of things. And she was in the thick of helping to push technology forward. Then after the war, she became a worldwide lecturer. She lectured in 2 or 3 continents, huge audiences of doctors, trying to explain the benefits of radiation treatment for medical enhancement. That was her thing. But in 1930, she began to visibly decline, and she was ultimately diagnosed with some form of anemia. And she died July 4th, 1934. And to a man, her biographers attribute her death to the very radium that she discovered. See, who knew that radium was a lethal contaminant, see? But we have a lethal contaminant in the spirit as well. A lot of times, you can't make the leap from something in the natural to the spiritual. A lot of times it won't work, but this isn't one of those times. This is going to work. As radium is a lethal contaminant and proximity thereto can be highly toxic, if not fatal, we have a spiritual contaminant that acts as its counterpart. And it is showcased in the Gospel of Proverbs, which is where you need to be making your way. Proverbs, dear friends, chapter 16. Let's see if we can't identify the silent killer. That's what we're going to talk about tonight, dear friends. It is a silent killer. Proverbs 16 and verse 18. Aha, it says here, pride goes before destruction and a haughty spirit before a fall. Now, a couple of things here. Pride is the word ga'a. It really means, in its root form in Hebrew, means to be high. Hebrew is not a conceptual language at all. It communicates in pictures. It communicates what you can visualize. The word ga'a means just to plain be high, probably too high for your own good. Pride goes before destruction. Destruction is the Hebrew word sheva. I don't want you to infer like a hand grenade and it blows everything up. Destruction, sheva, really, you know what I mean? It really means calamity, what the world would call bad luck. So pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit, that's the word gava, and it's very close to ga'a, translated pride, and it just means a haughty, overweening outlook, a sense of self-importance, etc., etc. But the buzzword, the word which is the fulcrum on which this message spins, is the preposition before. Sometimes prepositions are important in both Greek and Hebrew, and it's very important for this message in Hebrew. The word before, there are two Hebrew words translated to an English word before, all right? One has to do with time chronologically, and the other has to do with position, namely proximity. The word terem in Hebrew means before in terms of time. If you look at Proverbs 18 and verse 13, you'll see it there. He who answers a matter in its terem before he hears it, it's a folly and a shame to him. It's found in Psalm 90 and verse 2, before you formed the mountains and the earth, etc., etc., from everlasting to everlasting, thou art God, Psalm 90 verse 2. Well, that before is also terem chronologically. There's a chronological relationship between the one and the other. But there's another Hebrew word translated to before, and it's called lifne, and its root is pana, and pana in Hebrew means face. And lifne denotes proximity, and that is the word that is sitting in Proverbs 16 and verse 18, meaning that pride goes before destruction, that pride sort of sidles up to destruction. It's like a marching band where everybody's together. So that the upshot is, if you want calamity in your life, if you want bad luck, well then get close to pride. See, it's a lethal contaminant in the spirit realm, the same way that radium is in the natural. Y'all running with me so far? Very good. We're on board. All right. Now, there are two kinds of sin. Basically, there are sins of the heart and sins that we do, deeds. I mean, if you're going to shoplift from the job, every September they miss pads, liquid paper, pens from employees who, you know, don't want to buy them at Office Depot. Well, that's stealing. That's a sinful act. You know, if you run down people with your big mouth behind their back, I mean, this is something that you do. But another kind of sin is the sin of the heart, and that's this attitude thing. Hatred, jealousy, unforgiveness, you know, these are things that lurk in the heart that God sees all too well. Hebrews 4:13, all things are naked and open unto the eyes of him with whom we have to do. We're all familiar with that verse. God sees all that. And another one is pride. Pride is one of these attitudes of the heart. Pride is so effective that the devil finds it a handy tool. I mean, like a crescent wrench or a, you know, what is it, the vice grip, you know, I mean, very handy tool. I have my copy of Screwtape Letters. Now, this is fiction, but it's priceless, and I don't think it's that far from what really goes on in the spirit realm. C.S. Lewis, okay. Wormwood is a buck private in the devil's army. Screwtape is like a colonel, and he directs Wormwood in a series of letters. Each chapter is a letter written to Wormwood, advising him as to how to keep his patient, which is some human in England during World War II, how to keep him away from the Lord so at the tail end of the book they can drag his soul down to hell. And so it's quite insightful. And on page 71, we have some pertinent language here. My dear Wormwood, and he talks about he's having a little trouble with his patient, and he goes on to say this: I see only one thing to do at the moment. Your patient has become humble. Have you drawn his attention to this fact? All virtues are less formidable to us once the man is aware that he has them. Wait. This is why you got to slow down with C.S. Lewis. Well, let's go over that again. All virtues are less formidable to us once the man is aware that he has them. But this is especially true of humility. Catch him at the moment when he's really poor in spirit and smuggle into his mind the gratifying reflection, by Jove, I'm being humble. And almost immediately pride at his own humility will appear. If he awakes to the danger and tries to smother this new form of pride, then make him proud of his attempt. And so on, and go through as many stages as you please. The operative language here is get this poison into him at all costs, because it's highly useful for us. So I know this is fiction, but I've always thought he might be on to something when you read how some of these things work and use your own experience in the Lord and what we understand in the Word to see just how the devil works. And I can tell you pride is one of his favorite tools. Now, why does pride attract calamity? It, like a magnet, it attracts, pride goes before. Don't think of time. Lifne does not mean time. It means proximity. Right in front of it, like radium. You get too close to it for too long, it's toxic, if not lethal. It's the same thing with pride, all right? Why does pride attract calamity? Well, number one, because pride deceives. It makes you think that you're better than you really are. This can be dangerous. Look at Obadiah 3. I realize we're smack dab in the jungle of the minor prophets, but I will hold your hand and walk you through, okay? Let's see. If you find Joel, then go to Amos, and then you will be in Obadiah, judgment on Edom, right? But look at verse 3. This is some highly instructive language for our message tonight. Obadiah, verse 3. I hear pages turning. I've been accused of going too fast with considerable justification, because I do. So I will slow down a bit, all right? But Obadiah 3, the pride of your heart has deceived you. Do you hear it, dear friends? God is telling the Edomites exactly what went wrong. The pride of your heart has deceived you. What was my point? Pride deceives. And the poster boy is the Edomites, you know. I mean, look, if you don't think there's any room for improvement in your life, you know, when I was at USL many moons ago, I had to take a course in advertising. We had to study the world's, America's best commercials, you know, in the 60s and 70s. Alka-Seltzer had a bunch of them in the 60s. Great commercial. Well, Nine Lives Cat Food came up with this genius idea. An orange tabby called Morris. And he's the world's most finicky cat. You can't get a rise out of him for anything until the housewife opens the Nine Lives cat food, and then that'll get a rise out of Morris, right? All right. So I love Morris. My kids gave me a Morris the cat t-shirt. They know Morris is my man, all right? So In one commercial, a housewife's on the treadmill. Morris, Morris, I'm walking on the treadmill. And Morris goes, good for you. And she says, Morris, if you exercise and eat right, you'll feel better. And Morris says, who says I need improvement? I love those Morris the Cat commercials. But don't get the Morris the Cat mindset, all right? Who says I need improvement? Actually, God says you need improvement. And if you don't think you do, well, pride has already deceived you. It can be quite dangerous. Rusty and I are both World War II buffs. Every time you watch Operation Barbarossa, say it's going to invade Russia, I've always thought, what makes this guy think you can conquer a country 20 times the size of Germany with 10 times the population and twice the manufacturing capacity? But it's that he was so stuck on this racial superiority of the Germans. I mean, he actually believed this, that the Russians are racially inferior. They can't fight as well as the Wehrmacht. I don't care about the 10 times the population. We're going to kick the door in and the whole thing's going to fall. I mean, pride. How did that work out? So number one, pride can deceive you in dangerous capacities sometimes. All right, number two, why does pride attract calamity? Number two is because it provokes God. Pride provokes God. Why is this? I've never sat across a table and interviewed the Lord, okay? But I think that pride reminds God of the devil. Not a novice, 1 Timothy 3:6, lest being puffed up with pride, he fall into the same condemnation as the devil. See? I do believe that in Ezekiel, well, you're in Obadiah, look at Ezekiel 28. Well, let's see. We're kind of in the neighborhood here. Ezekiel chapter 28. Most of you know that's the passage, one of the two main passages on the creation of the devil. Or the evolution of the devil, where it came from, et cetera, et cetera. But Ezekiel 28, and look at verse 17. Your heart was lifted up because of your beauty, et cetera, et cetera. And I mean, I think that when God sees pride, he can see it plain as day. It just reminds him of the devil. 1 Peter chapter 5, let me show you this one too. 1 Peter chapter 5, and then we're going to run over to Isaiah. But I know you've seen this before, but I want to point something out to you. 1 Peter 5, 5, where under inspiration, Peter says, likewise, you younger, and that doesn't mean younger in age. It means younger in the walk. Some of you newcomers to this, all right? Likewise, you younger, submit yourselves to your elders. Yes, all of you be submissive one to another. And here's some great advice. Be clothed with humility. And why is that? Because God resists the proud. And that's an interesting verb. The word tasso means to set or to place. It's got the prefix anti, which means against. God sets himself against the proud. It's in the middle voice to boot. So that's pretty strong. That the Lord resists is okay, but I'm telling you, in the Greek, it's a little more colorful. He sets him personally, sets himself against the proud. That's why it provokes God. And I'll show you. Look at Isaiah 13. You know, the Lord's going to wrap this thing up one day, as we all know, and I want to make sure that you know this is here, Isaiah 13. Well, you know, the day of the Lord comes. I mean, this is verse 10, stars of heaven, the constellations. I mean, this is an end time verse, all right? You can match it up with some stuff in Revelation 6, etc. But look at verse 11. I will punish the world. And that the Hebrew word tevel means the globe, earth as opposed to Mars, Venus. I mean, the whole world as an entity. I will punish the world for its evil, the wicked for their iniquity, and I will halt the arrogance of the proud. A lot of what drives these world leaders is they're just intense, like this guy Klaus Schwab. You know, you will own nothing and you will be happy. What makes somebody think he can tell the world what they're going to? I mean, come on, you know. Pride. I mean, pride on steroids. So pride provokes God. And I brought with me a little quote from one of our good friends, the late Dr. Robert Schuller. Robert Schuller of a Crystal Cathedral fame. You remember him, right? At his height in the 80s, that hour of power thing, it reached, let's see, it says 180 countries, 20 million per viewing. That's very tragic. 180 countries. The prime focus of Dr. Schuller's ministry concerns the self-esteem of the individual. This was reflected in most of his earlier books, but was never specially formulated until 1982 when he wrote Self-Esteem, The New Reformation. Okay, and he goes on and on. Self-esteem then, or pride in being a human being, says Schuller, is the single greatest need facing the human race today. He says, I strongly suggest that self-love is the ultimate will of man, that what you really want more than anything else in the world is the awareness that you are a worthy person. And then he says, do not fear pride. Wow. The easiest job God has is to humble us. God's almost impossible task is to keep us believing every hour of every day how great we are. Impossible task. Everybody out there thinks how great we are. Absolutely. As the sons and daughters on planet Earth. This is cyanide different. These people are tuning into cyanide. And then in one of his books, he's got a book called What Does It Mean to Be Born Again? And this was his definition. To be changed from a negative to a positive self-image, from inferiority to self-esteem. That's the born-again experience. As I say, this is absolute cyanide. Oh. So pride provokes God. Yeah, it's in the Satanic Bible too. Oh, yeah, that you can turn it sideways, it'll leak out of that thing, you know. Not that I've read it, but I've seen parts of it, and I enough to know I don't want to read it. But pride deceives, number one. Number two, pride provokes God. Number three is pride prevents instruction. Here, look at Proverbs chapter 12 with me, all right? Proverbs chapter 12, well, what does it say? Proverbs 12 and verse 1. Whoever loves instruction loves knowledge, but he who hates correction is, the King James will say brutish, the New King James will say stupid. You get it. You don't have a lot of mental machinery, all right? I mean, if you don't want to, if you can't receive correction, Solomon has a very dim view of that. He takes a very dim view of that. If you remember King Uzziah in 2 Chronicles 26, I mean, he was, we're not going to turn there, but a very prosperous king. I mean, he conquered the Arabians, he conquered the Ammonites, the Philistines, they're bringing tribute to him. I mean, unemployment is at like 3%, inflation's 1.5%, the shekel's murdering all the other currencies on the world. Everything's going great for Uzziah. And then he decides he wants to be a priest as well as a king. And he walked in there and the priest withstood him and he refused to accept correction. Hey, Uzziah, you're a king, not a priest. This is for the, only we are authorized to offer incense. You remember that? And then the leprosy, right there, what, pride goes before proximity, well, calamity. In this case, it was leprosy. So you can see that in real time. I can tell you, when I first started our church up there, we had a couple of Messianic Jews, and one was Phyllis. I have a very fine recollections of Phyllis. And one day in the 2000, 2001, something like that, I had been preaching out of the Old Testament, and I was using the word Palestine. And Phyllis is a dyed-in-the-wool support of Israel, obviously. Messianic Jew, she loves Israel. All right. So she came up to me. She said, you know, Pastor, you may want to reconsider using the word Palestine. And I said, well, why? She says, well, because, you see, Hadrian invented that when he kicked the Jews out in the AD 130s. And it comes from the Philistine word, the word for Philistine, you know, Pelishti. And so it's meant to disenfranchise Israel verbally of what is theirs. Now, look, I spent 8 years in the Gulag over there on Gentilly Boulevard, and I never heard that, not once, in studying Old Testament. Never heard that. So I didn't talk down to her. Say, well, no, I said, let me take that under advisement. I got her in the end, I find out she's right. And so from then on, I've never used the word Palestine. She got me to start using the word the Holy Land, because I don't want to be seen by God as contributing to the disenfranchisement of his people. But I mean, she didn't. I don't think Phyllis even went to college, but I mean, she was a voracious reader and she was on the ball, you know. So, yeah, I mean, you have to be open to correction sometimes, you know, or instruction. Otherwise, we may have some contamination in there, you know. All right. Number four is this: pride, and this is the most lethal. Pride precludes salvation. I mean, unbelief is the universal transgression. Is that right? He'll convict the world of sin, righteousness, and judgment to come, of sin because they believe not on me. You have to get rid of a lot of pride to say that you believe that this Jew came down from heaven and died for you personally, because you're admitting a need right there. You know, as Morris said, who says I need improvement? The whole human race needs it, right? So, pride, look at Matthew 18, for example. Look at Matthew chapter 18. Along these lines, all right? Matthew 18. Now, the director of admissions is speaking. I mean, you think he's authoritative enough? This is the director of admissions into heaven. Matthew 18. They're asking him, verse 1, who's the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? Verse 2, calls a little child, sets him in the midst of them, and says, unless you are converted and become as little children, you shall by no means. Very strong in the Greek, by no. You can't say not. You have to say by no means. No way, Jose. No, never. What part of no way don't you understand? I mean, it's that strong. You have to translate it by no. You will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. Therefore, whoever, and here's our buzzword, humbles himself as this little child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. But, I mean, you can't even get in there unless you divest yourself of enough pride to humble yourself like, you know, the little child. I can tell you, before, you didn't know Brother McGovern before he got saved. Probably a good thing. But if you remember Fonzie from Happy Days, that was me, okay? I was a carbon copy of Fonzie from Happy Days. And, you know, my mother would always, when she got in with the charismatic movement in St. Edward's in the 70s, that was the conduit out for a lot of women, you know. And that's when Leela started realizing, wait, there might be more to this than just a mass. And so she would always try to get me to come to this. Please, please come. And I would say, no, I'm not going, because I heard that old ladies kiss you at these things. And there's no way the Fonz is getting kissed by an old lady, all right? So, oh, and it was her birthday. Oh, please, for my birthday. Nope, I ain't going, all right? But, you know, this is the kind of thing you tell your own mother no for a birthday. Because you got so much of Fonzie in you, translated pride, arrogance, haughtiness, the whole bit, something our culture glorifies. When I was at USL, I remember the noon meal, I went into the cafeteria. Randy was already saved. Randy got saved in 1974. He got in with the Catholic Charismatic Bunch on USL's campus, and he had a friend whose name is Garrett, who was the dictionary caption picture of a nerd, N-E-R-D. When you hear the word nerd, you see his face, all right? That was Garrett. He was one of them. I go into the cafeteria, And Garrett is sitting at the table alone. All right, he's eating and he's eating alone. So I'm thinking, all right, do I give him a break or not? So I'm calculating here. Now, I think my stock is high enough to where I won't be hurt if I'm seen next to him. But I know his stock is so low that I can bring it up if he's seen eating with me. So, I mean, this is what I'm thinking. So I'm thinking, should I or shouldn't I? I think I'm going to give him a break. So like Fonzie, you know, I just walked up and I know I'm doing him a big favor. So I plop my tray on the table. And he goes, oh, hi. I said, all right. So I'm getting my fork. So what's cracking, Garrett? You know? He says, we just had a communion service in our dorm room. It was so anointed. It was like the Lord Jesus was present. And I went, I couldn't believe he's doing this to me. I mean, I'm doing the guy a favor, and he's giving his Lord Jesus stuff. You know, but I'm saying, you talk about keep you away from the kingdom. What do we read? Humble yourself as a child. I mean, there was no way Brother McGovern had a snowball in hell's chance. Just on that score, the pride thing. See, because, well, pride precludes salvation. All right. Now, Brother McGovern, that was a very highly instructive set of guidelines for pride. May we leave now? Nay. Because we have to undertake some tests so that we can detect the presence of contamination, spiritual contamination. That is pride. In other words, remember what I said. If you hate somebody, you know it. You refuse to forgive somebody, you know it. But a lot of times there are little pockets of pride that we carry around. The smaller the better, but it's still there, and it is a lethal contaminant. So we want to find out whether we have any traces of pride. I brought my little Geiger counter here, okay? And we're going to ask a few questions, and we're going to apply the Geiger counter and just see if we got a reading here, okay? So number one, these are some questions you have to ask yourself along the lines of detection for pride. Number one is, do I like to impress others? Do I like to impress? All right, so you went out, you spent your life savings on a Lexus convertible. Is it that you can't wait to go show the old folk, you know, your homies, that you're driving a Lexus convertible? Beep, 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 beep. Uh-oh. Beep, 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 beep. We're getting a reading here, dear friends, all right? Are you in love with the mirror? You need a mirror. I used a mirror so my hair doesn't look like, you know, the wrath of God before I came here. But I mean, are you in love with the mirror? You know, I'm at the gym every day. You ought to see some of these guys. They look at the mirror. What they like to do is look at the mirror as they're working out. It's disgusting. And it so disgusts me that I make a point never to look in the mirror while I'm doing this because I don't want to look like them. But are you in love with the mirror? And a lot of people are. I mean, this is just a form of impressing others. Do I like to impress others? All right, back to the Fonz. So when I was at USL, I was what you would call an intellectual snob, okay? For example, I read David Copperfield, Charles Dickens, that's his most famous. What's about this thick? Like 900 pages. Was it a sign? No. I read it because I wanted to be able to say I read it. So if I was in the company with some English majors, I could say, you haven't read David Copperfield? See? So this, who's read David Copperfield? Come on, you know. But, you know, it's this whole thing of like to impress others. That's the only reason I read David Copperfield. This is called being an intellectual snob. So another version of this is, do I like to be the center of attention? Do I like to be noticed by others, whether individually or in a room? Beep, 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 beep. Got a reading there. Beep, beep. So, yes, do I like to impress others? Test number two. Oh, boy. When others get recognition in my field, does resentment begin to surface? For example, remember Snow White? Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs? The wicked queen. Mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the fairest of them all? And the mirror always said, thou, O queen, art fairest in all the land. Well, you know, Snow White was born. Snow White begins to grow up, and Snow White begins to, shall we say, fill out a little bit. And one day the queen goes, mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the fairest of them all? And this time the mirror says, thou, O queen, art fair, 'tis true, but Snow White is 1,000 times fairer than you. Well, we can't have that. So she wants to kill Snow White. She got to hide out with the seven dwarfs and all this kind of stuff. See, no, nobody can be prettier than the queen. When others get recognition in my field, does resentment service. Let's take a 500, 600, 700 member church, and you got two or three girls who can sing. I don't have a problem with this, as long as it's not a performance. Brother Ken used to do this. Mary Foxworthy would get up there playing. They get Jenny Taylor, she would sing. As long as it's anointed and it's not a performance, I don't really have a problem with it. But suppose you got a 500, 600 member church, and you got two or three girls in there who sing, and one day, let's say Jenny Taylor decides to come. She sang in the opera. Jenny's got an opera voice. So Jenny is going to sing, we shall behold him, you know, a song like that with this opera voice. I just wonder, for those two or three girls who are sitting there listening to this, beep, 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 beep. In other words, where did she come from? I used to be queen of the hill. See, you got to watch. You got to, preachers are the same way. Now, I got to tell you, brother, I've had this before. You got a guy who can really preach, all right? Okay, I'm listening. I want to get something. Of course, preachers have a tendency to look at the preacher objectively and say, oh, let me see what you got. Show me what you got, you know, okay? Rather than expect to be ministered to. But if a preacher, and I've had this before, he'll start showing some proficiency in Greek or Hebrew, and it's really good. And I can feel this begin to surface. You know, like, wait a minute, this is my thing. You know, and God's got to say, hey, moron, what makes you think you're the only one who can do this? You know, so I know what this feels like. You can kind of feel, but you're aware of it. See, you tamp it down, and you tell yourself, hey, moron, just like God says. Who says you're the only one who can do this? But it exposes a little pocket of pride. You know, I'm going to J. Doerr's church out there in Abita Springs, all right? Small congregation, because, well, he puts brass knuckles on and punches you right in the face, you know. So he don't care. So it's not for the faint of heart, but anyway. But David, his brother, leads the worship. And you know, when I first started going there, about a month into it, David comes up to me. He says, Brother Rick, I'd like you to lead the worship next week, you know? And I couldn't believe it. I said, I mean, if somebody said, no, I'm not going anywhere. Nobody's sick. We just want you to lead the worship and just minister to us. I couldn't believe it. Worship leaders, at least in these big churches, are highly territorial, like the shark in Jaws, territorial. This is my territory, Buster. You want to get up here, you got to work your way, like we're in the union or something, you know, seniority. You want to get up here, you know, this is my thing, see. But with David asking me to lead the worship, crickets, nothing there. That's good. See. So when others get recognition in my field, all right, you ladies, you make this killer potato salad, right? You're known for your potato salad. Then we have another girl comes into church, and she makes a super duper killer potato salad. And now everybody's making over her potato salad. We feel this coming up. Who do you think you are? You know, oh. Beep, 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 beep. So when others get recognition in my field, does resentment surface? All right, number three, do I find it hard to admit when I'm wrong? Listen, people with pride are allergic to apologizing. Do I find it hard to admit when I'm wrong? I'll tell you a rookie mistake I made when we had our church up. This was so stupid. But, you know, it was November of 2000. The presidential election was coming, Bush versus Gore. The Sunday before the election, I actually got up there and gave a Republican pep talk. thinking nobody could sit under my ministry and be a Democrat. Guess what? The two Messianic Jews, Phyllis and Lee, they were Democrats. They were fit to be tied. So Phyllis was going to leave, and of course, the Lord just called me up. God said, don't you ever do that again. I heard that. Lord, I get it. I get it. I pulled the wrong string. It was wrong. It never happened again. I had to call Phyllis, I mean, hat in hand, and eat about 10 pounds of crow. But if I didn't do that, she's going to leave, and God's going to be furious at me. See? So, look, you have to understand that was a rookie mistake. Never made it again after that. I'm a fast learner, different. When it comes to this stuff, when God calling you up one side, don't ever do that again, and you hear it, I'm a fast learner. It won't happen again. But, I mean, I had to apologize profusely. She had two words when I was through. She said, apology accepted. And we went on and never brought up politics or anything. She's a big Obama thing, you know, person with a Bible with Obama on it. No, we didn't even bring it up. We got along great. See, so, okay. She's my sister in the Lord, and politics, this too shall pass. I mean, this kingdom of God, this is eternal stuff, you know. So, but, you know, if you find, if the blame goes east, west, north, south, but not here, we marriage counseling, a lot of the marriage counseling you do, you know, then they're reluctant to blame themselves. It's the wife's fault, the husband's fault, et cetera, et cetera. You know, pride will rationalize. A lot of times when people rationalize, you got a pocket of pride in there. Beep, 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 beep. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And this is the difference between King Saul and King David. Look at 1 Samuel with me, chapter 15. Huh? 1 Samuel chapter 15. All right. Well, if you know anything about the life of Saul, this is it. This is when he dug himself in. All right, 1 Samuel 15, but I want to show you one particular component in this narrative here. Well, okay, he doesn't kill the Amalekites. He spares Agag alive, etc. We know the story. In 17, the one that didn't look familiar. 1 Samuel 15, 21. Verse 20. Saul said to Samuel, but I've obeyed the voice of the Lord and gone on the mission. 1 Samuel, now 15, verse 20. Gone on the mission on which the Lord sent me and brought back Agag, king of Amalek, and I've utterly destroyed the Amalekites. But the people, so here we're passing the buck, right? But the people took of the plunder, the sheep, the oxen, the best of the things which should have been utterly destroyed and sacrificed to the Lord your God at Gilgal. And then Samuel has this immortal statement in verses 22 and 23. And, finally, in verse 24, we get Saul to own up, to fess up. Verse 24, I have sinned, I have transgressed the commandment of the Lord. That's over against David in 2 Samuel chapter 12 when Nathan confronts him, huh? In 2 Samuel 12, you did this secretly, verse 12, but I will do this thing before all Israel, before the sun. And immediately, verse 13, 2 Samuel 12, 13, David said to Nathan, I've sinned again. You know, this is not like pulling teeth. David was quick to, for all his faults, he was quick to repent, and this is a prime example. I have sinned against the Lord. And Nathan says, of course, the Lord has put away your sin. You shall not die. There's a lot could be said about that, but we'd be chasing a rabbit, which we don't have time to chase. Okay. So, yes, do I find it hard to admit when I'm wrong? And is an apology something you're almost allergic to? That's a bad sign. Bad sign, dear friends. All right. Number four is this. Do I have a hard time submitting to authority? Now, this is not only rebellion at work. A lot of times it's this overinflated estimation of yourself at work. Look at Romans 13, of course. Do I have a hard time submitting it to authority? Well, you better not if you know what's good for you. Romans 13, verse 1, let every soul be subject. Ah, middle voice, brother. Let every soul subject him or herself. That's a little stronger. You willfully subject yourself to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and the authorities that exist or appointed, they have been, perfect tense, they have been appointed by God. So, I mean, you have to submit to it. I understand there are maybe perhaps exceptions when they outlaw the Bible, outlaw home Bible studies or whatever, that we may go into the oven to that extent. Well, that's another story, but, you know... another aspect to this is, how many times do I ignore? I simply ignore the rules because I'm so impressed with myself. In other words, the rules are for little people. They're for the little people, you know, not for me. Washington politicians are the world's worst here. The world's worst. The rules are for the little people. We're sort of elevated. We're a class above, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, the mafia, the organized crime guys. I mean, you own a restaurant, you don't pay. You've seen some of these mafia movies. Wise guys don't pay. Yeah, you eat a meal and you walk out without paying. If the guy objects, you threaten you're going to burn his place down. See, the rules don't apply to you. They're full of pride. I don't know if you remember Steve Foley. Yeah, he went to Jesuit. He was in my class. Played for Denver, 11 seasons. Still has the all-time interception record for the Denver Broncos. So Foley and I were very good friends. I got his cell phone number. I talked to him a lot. He uses he's a big Christian now, and he uses his stature in Denver, you know, to address high school kids and all. He does a great work for the Lord. Well, when he retired from football in the late 80s, we got together, and he was trying to explain to me what it's like to deal with these football players and this gargantuan ego they have. In other words, Foley says, you have to bust out the door jam so they can get their ego in the room when they walk through. See, and what does that translate into? You know, you got enough money to buy a Ferrari, it can go 180 miles an hour, you see if it can. How many of these football players were flagged down going 150 miles an hour somewhere and they're half drunk, and they're doing this because they know, even if I go in a central lockup, they're going to get me on that football field. So they're going to find a way to get me on that field come Sunday. See, this is a prideful thing that causes you to think, well, the speed limit, that's for the little people. See, not for me. So, do I have a hard time submitting to authority? I mean, the rules apply to everybody equally, as we know. And then finally, number five, do I find myself feeling a little superior to others? Maybe because of who I am, you know, a certain stature. If you're a Kennedy in Massachusetts, there is a certain stature that you have. I was listening to Rush Limbaugh many years ago driving, and somebody called in from Massachusetts. They were in a return line to return items after Christmas or something, and this one of the Kennedys wanted to cut in front of the line, and the lady said, well, no, this person was there. The guy said, you know who I am? You know, I mean, see, you got the magic last name, a Kennedy in Massachusetts. It tends to give you a rather overinflated estimation of yourself. See, who I am, who I know, how well connected are you? See, what I've accomplished. You know, some guys have a law degree and a medical degree. You got to be brilliant. You got to be brilliant to be a doctor. If you can get out of medical school, you are a genius. But to get a law degree and a medical degree, I mean, that is quite an accomplishment. You know, or what I can do. You know, I found out when I busted up my hand many years ago that the surgeons with the most stature are not necessarily the heart surgeons, they're the hand surgeons. A guy who can fix your hand. They got to go to medical school, and then they got to do 3, 4, 5 years after that. And there's a long internship to, because the hand is so complicated and all this kind of stuff. Well, you know, hand surgeons generally have an overinflated estimation of themselves. This guy who did my hand, this guy, this was long before Donald Trump got into politics. This was 2011. I used to say, he's got the bedside manner of Sonny Corleone, and he's got all the humility of Donald Trump. That's what I used to say. This guy, he was the most arrogant. So one day in rehabilitation, he was there. I would do a rehab for the thumb and all this. And I said, you know, Dr. Recant, how close did I come? You know, it was a hatchet thing. You know, I almost cut my thumb off with an axe, you know. Brother McGovern, how could you be? Look, stupid is as stupid does. It's a long story, but I almost lost my thumb. Anyway, and this guy's brilliant. He put it back on and kept it on. But I asked him, Dr. Recant, how close did I come? He reaches in his pocket, and he pulls out a butterscotch candy. He says, you see this paper? See how thick it is? He said, if you'd have gone any further than this, the width of this thing, he said, even I couldn't have put your thumb back. He said that. Even I couldn't have. These hand surgeons, man, they make a fortune. They deserve it. But the ego... See, do I find myself feeling superior to others? How about this? Do I have the feeling that I'm admired by those around me? This is Hollywood level pride here. You know, when they're asking for your autograph all the time, telling you how great, and I've seen all your movies, what else can you think of yourself? You wonder why it is so difficult for somebody in Hollywood to actually get saved and become a genuine born-again believer. That what you have to unlearn, and not the least of which is this arrogance. See, do I get the feeling that I'm admired by those around me? The remedy for that is Romans 12. Oh, we're right in the neighborhood. Or look at Romans 12 and verse 3. Romans 12, 3, for I say through the grace given to me, write. It's only because of the grace given to him that he can write the stuff and be inspired. To everyone who's among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think soberly as God has dealt to each one a measure for everybody's on the same in this kingdom. In the world, no. In this kingdom, everybody's on the same level. And that is why you can never think that you're admired by those around you. You know, as we wind this down, let me say that pride is so detestable that even God doesn't want to get near you. Look at Psalm 138. Look at this. Psalm 138, saints. Did you know this was in here? Psalm 138 and... when you get there, I need you to find verse 6, all right? Psalm 138 and verse 6. Though the Lord be high, yet he regards the lowly, but the proud he knoweth afar off. You know, it's kind of like when we were in Pennsylvania and we had a poodle and she was a predator and we had woods in the back. You open up the sliding door, there's a deck and there's woods. And, you know, one night she really was dying to go out. I don't know what's out there. We pull the sliding door open. She runs out there. She comes back. She gets in the house. Oh, what is that smell? Oh, oh, oh. She tied it up with a skunk, okay? I mean... Michelle had to get the dog in the tub with tomato juice, lemon, vinegar, whatever they said to do. It was a week before we got that smell out of our house, just for the dog walking in there, you know. But when you try to bring that pride up into heaven, you have the same effect. The angels go, oh, what is that smell? And everybody wants to get away from you. It's like you got odor of skunk. You remember the cartoon Pepe Le Pew? Yeah, there's a reason they called him that. If you haven't ever smelled a skunk, you'll never forget that nauseating smell. You know, and that's what you smell like trying to go up into heaven. The Lord doesn't want to be near you. The angels, everybody's backing away from you like you're a leper, you know. And it's all attributive to, well, pride. And the pièce de résistance, dear friends, the coup de grâce, as the French say. Final scripture is Proverbs 16. I'll leave you with this one. Proverbs 16, and look at verse 5. Proverbs 16, 5. Everyone who is proud in heart is a toeva, Bill McGovern. My Bible says abomination. Well, but Solomon wrote toeva, which is the strongest word in Hebrew to convey what is absolutely offensive to God in the highest degree, a toeva. Don't just trip over that word abomination. It is a strong Hebrew word. And I'm trying to convey the full strength of that thing when I tell you these things. Not just an offense to the Lord. He's not just offended. It's an abomination. Though forces join hands, none will go unpunished, etc. That's another thought. But yes, everyone proud in heart is an abomination. You hope God accepts you. You know, on the other side, will He accept you? You're like David Duke walking into an NAACP convention, or you're like a Jew walking into, you know, Hitler's inner circle or something like that. I mean, absolute abomination. See, Marie Curie. Put radium on the map, but it cost her life. Why is that? Who knew? Radium is highly lethal. When it's near to you for prolonged periods of time, we all know that today. Just go to the dentist. They put that thing on you. We all know that, right? But pride's the same way in the spirit realm. See, you can't detect radium readily. And pride's the same way. It's difficult to detect it. That's why we have our beep, 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 why we have our Geiger counter test here, so we can give you some guidelines. You with me on that? All right, I'm through. Don't you love a preacher who knows when to shut up? All right, I'm through. All right. All right.